it's Lou and welcome to the series finale of Series 10. Today I'm excited to be joined by Legacy Russell, Executive Director and Chief Curator of the experimental arts institution, The Kitchen, one of New York's oldest non-profit spaces. Legacy is a New York City-based writer, curator and author of the critically acclaimed Glitch Feminism, a Manifesto. Last year, I hugely enjoyed the New Bend exhibition at Hauser & Wirth in Somerset, curated by Legacy, who brought together 12 contemporary artists working in the race, class, and gender traditions of quilting and textile practice. This exhibition was followed by a talk in the London Gallery, reflecting on the influence of G's Bend and the ways in which the Black diasporic practices of textile work had transformed the imaginations of abstraction and modernism across time. You can listen to this talk online, so do keep an eye out for the link in the podcast description. And it was around that time that Legacy and I chatted about her joining me on the show to discuss Black Meme, the book that she was working on at the time. And here we are.
Part of the impetus for Black Meme and thinking about why it is that this text needs to exist and why it is that it's, I feel, a very important story to be told is this very assumption that, you know, the frame of the internet and its assumptions around transphobia, homophobia, ableism, you know, racism, classism, sexism, that all of these things, right, are somehow troubled because of the internet, when in reality, these were troubles, as we can see, that have mapped back to the 1900s and before, that have shaped and established the very frame within which we have been able to put language to our visual culture, and that, you know, have infused the internet and built it for what it is today.
I'm delighted to have Legacy join me to talk about Black Meme, which is due to be published soon on May the 7th. Black Meme focuses on the history and production of the meme, tracing through Black visual culture from its first appearance in the early 20th century all the way through to present times. It is a critical dissection of race, class, and gender as performed online and offline, and emphasizes the central role that Black contributions have played in the development of digital culture. On the meme, Legacy says, I want to talk about the economy and engine of this and perhaps push further a discussion about how we can hold ourselves accountable to how this material is produced and circulated. Okay, and let's go straight to the conversation. Let's start, as Black Meme does in the 20th century, with the 1913 American black and white silent film Lime Kiln Field Day. This is the oldest surviving film featuring black actors. The film rushes were found in 1939 by MoMA's first film director, Iris Barry. And then later in 2004, the gallery's curator, film curator at the time, began working on the restored components of the film. And he made a really interesting statement that you focused on in Black Meme. And he stated at the time that he would like it to go viral. And it's here that your exploration of the Black Meme begins. And moving through this discussion of the Black Meme is your focus on important moments in contemporary cultural history, starting with Lime Kiln Field Day and including the circulation of lynching postcards, Michael Jackson's Thriller music video, the first internet gif of a dancing baby. And we go on with all these really important cultural moments. And you use these as examples, and you pose the argument that without the contributions of black people, that digital culture would not exist in its current form. But can you tell us a little bit more about this common thread that runs throughout all of these examples of memes and how you feel that they can help us understand perhaps the lack of agency that we as black people have over our own image in the present day in digital culture?
Absolutely. Well, I want to maybe back up to move forward and kind of talk about what this book is, right? It's a book that draws from examples that predate the internet as we now know it, but of course aims to contextualize and bring together different citations and cultural moments that allow for us to think of a bigger picture when we ask about how we got here to where we are in this moment now, where, of course, there are continuing to be so many urgent and important discussions around viral Black culture. I think a lot of people, when they think about this idea of the Black meme, they're thinking about this period of time that we're in right now, right? They're thinking about, you know, 1990 to present and the internet as it has lived through an understanding of cyberspace and intersections therein and how those things have been creatively applied and then also institutionalized. For me, it feels really important, though, to think about as well, right, that aspects of these cultural moments have driven how technology has changed. And also as well, certainly too, thinking about Blackness as a ultimate technology of transformation has also, of course, been applied over time as really a kind of raw data and material that has been extracted from. And so this is why this book starts in the 1900s, right, and kind of moves us forward through multiple chapters of space and time to the present day. Because there's an opportunity, I think, to reflect on the ways that these histories actually are more expansive, that they extend beyond this moment now in terms of how we understand our relationship to screens. And that certainly, too, right, that viral culture and how aspects of our attention has been shaped in relationship to these materials has begun in cinema in many, many ways, right? So, you know, the idea of the moving image, of course, is a great place to start. And as you said, with Limekiln, that this is a critical example, recognizing its position inside of the institution of MoMA, the way in which, of course, that that has been expanded and applied over time. And of course, the work and recent presentation over these last several years of Garrett Bradley's America, which resurrects this film as being a source material to refract and perhaps shape and shift how we look at material that engages Black culture as a viral point and genesis for the work that we are doing now, and as well the kind of momentum of this text overall. So I think, you know, if there is a surprise within this, right, thinking about, you know, why start there, right, and why start, you know, in the 1900s and think about its relationship as well, moving outward from there to the traditions and violence of lynching postcards, to thinking about Michael Jackson's incredible debut of Thriller and the significance of that. And like you said as well, you know, the first internet GIF and how, of course, that had many different components that were certainly raced and classed, that these are core moments where we are seeing images transmit, and that Blackness as a catalyst for that becomes part of the cultural capital of how these materials move, how they are gourmandized by the public, and as well, what agency those materials do or do not have as they are both maybe empowered and disempowered across these different moments in time. So complicating some of these points has been really important to me, and it's been really necessary to think differently about internet culture is not something that is shaped purely by the ways that we look at the internet now. I think that we have actually a very limited view on this idea of digitality, and aspects of where we are now and how it has been informed in a broader view is really what the thesis of this project is, the ongoing research, and also really a kind of call into presence to think about how to be critical when we are receiving these images, thinking about them, historicizing them, and as well sharing them.
And talking about some examples that you focus on in the book, it was really amazing to me that you honed in on Michael Jackson's Thriller that we've mentioned here, particularly because I was a child of the 80s. So that was a, you know, a very seminal moment in my history. And I had not...
It's a big moment.
Yeah. And I had not, you know, the way that you presented it and framed it within this context in Black Meme was just so exciting and enlightening and informing to me. And the Thriller album established this idea that Black viral media can be self-directed. You know, this was an embodiment of Jackson's creative, like his own creative endeavor, and that Black artists or producers can have power over its transition. And in Black Meme, you quote the journalist Michael A. Gonzalez, who said in his 2014 essay for Ebony that the era of the 1980s turned thousands into zombies. And it's so interesting how you look at the way this imagery of a zombie represented a visualization or embodiment of America's fears at the time. Can we hear a little bit more about this and share your thoughts on this with the audience?
I think to go back, as a, also as a child of the 80s, right, to go back to that period of time, I think Michael Jackson's Thriller, I remember when I first saw it, it was probably one of the most exciting things I had ever set eyes on. And, you know, of course, I think we can speak about Jackson's work in relationship to its contribution and also at the same time recognize, right, the very deep and troubled history of Michael Jackson as it has unfolded over time and been narrated and engaged. So I certainly want to recognize that and acknowledge it and to unpack a little bit, thinking about, you know, what did Thriller do? Thriller brought into the domestic arena the possibility to see something on loop, material on loop, for, you know, the first time at a monumental scale. People could purchase these VHS tapes and bring them home with them, transform the technology of our viewership, quite literally, right? As the very idea that this material could be produced as it was, transmitted as it was, carried with us, and also at the same time too, transform our viewing experience at home. So, you know, in a very fundamental level, that really was the work, right? That was the work of what Thriller achieved. And, you know, when we think about viral culture, right, we have, of course, learned so much from the ways in which aspects of these different technologies can be brought into our home space, that actually the domesticity of technology is a part of the discussion here and what as well both makes aspects of this very noxious, right? It's hard to detect because of the fact that it lives with us at home in our ordinary everyday and has, you know, in this moment now, in many ways, been very neutralized. But, you know, there was a moment in time where this was abnormal. It was unusual, right, to have this type of presence in your home space. It was a rarity and quite extraordinary, right? And so to bring us back to that moment in time feels really important. And as well to reflect about, you know, how, of course, technology is never set apart from the politics of the world around it. So, you know, in the case of the 1980s, this was a really critical period of time. I think many of the moments that we are experiencing now, thinking about the very many complex and compounded dynamics of the ongoing culture wars, and thinking about as well to the history and traditions that were initiated by Reaganomics, the prison industrial complex, and some of the core practices that continued to expand in that period of time tied to surveillance and policing of Black people. And then as well, thinking about, you know, the intersections of that alongside of some of the kind of core assumptions of Blackness as a threat, right? And where that, of course, intersects with the health industrial complex, recognizing that this was a key turning point in the HIV/AIDS epidemic and its rise into being, right? People understanding for the first time its real impact and how, of course, that would travel. So I think that there is, you know, to the point of Gonzalez's essay, that, you know, there is this moment of quite literally the zombification of a broader population, right? That folks were engaging with a deep level of fear and anxiety around this idea of otherness. And what Jackson's film does is it resurrects that fear and manifests it in a way that is so concrete and literalized that, you know, of course, as we watch it now and think about what was happening in the world in that exact moment in time, it becomes quite a devastating social and cultural text. It also is a text that, you know, in addition to that, not only engages this idea of like a body in decay, right? Because of course, we're seeing these zombies in motion, and that this idea of a sort of zombie being, right, would be a contagion that would take on different forms and kind of pass on as a pathology across many different sites in a way that almost mimics a form of a kind of algorithm in its own right. So, you know, I think there's that. And then I also appreciate that there's a huge part of this that, you know, comes to this intersection of race and class that, of course, within the very being of this Thriller material, right, that we're thinking about, what did it mean to really have the privilege to be able to watch these things at home? What did it mean to be able to purchase these materials? The rise as well of bootlegging in the 1980s was something that was significant and also, I think, continues to drive some of how we think deeply about the innovations of remix and Black culture because, of course, you know, the VHS lent to a new possibility of being able to bootleg and replicate Black material in a way that had never happened before in history, right? So this too is about the internet, right? It's about, you know, the ways in which we were beginning to come to an understanding of how we can be empowered in taking for ourselves the replication of materials that perhaps were not ours and actually having them cut up, remixed and reproduced in a way that actually felt authentic and empowered, right? By sharing these points across different sites of culture, place and space. So, you know, for me, I think it's a really exciting moment, right, to talk about, but I think it also is a moment too, where we begin to see what it means to have different cultural and social texts and subtexts brought into a broader frame inside of a mainstream audience that was really thirsty to consume Black culture and to learn from Jackson as a sort of medium of exchange, right? So Michael Jackson, in many ways, of course, as many folks like Margo Jefferson, for example, has written about, was an incredible icon, but also there was a locality of Jackson. It was a meeting place. It was an idea, right, that people were also trying to grapple with about, you know, who this person was alongside of what was being produced and the material of that, how it could be extracted and exchanged through and beyond his personhood. So the Thriller music video, right, this was something that set a blueprint forward for everything that came after in so many ways, right? It was a core turning point inside of our culture. And also, you know, much like Lime Kiln Field Day, right, has left an impression as to how Black material should live and, you know, pushed us further to think about what it means to engage in a sense of belonging and ownership. As that material, of course, has continued to deepen in its significance and its analysis over time.
That's a really interesting focus on Black material and how that lives and how it's transmitted. And then we move on to, in your book, material from the white imagination, which is Baby Cha-Cha, which turned into being the first digital meme. Internet users could distribute this image of a baby. I'm sure some of us of a certain age, you know, can remember this, and they could distribute this image royalty free. You know, it became very popular. It became viral. And the founder of the company that went on to create the dancing baby, Michael Girard, he reflected on this phenomenon and on this image of the baby. And he reflected that it spread because it was the first GIF. It was easily transmissible, but also that people, and I quote, enjoyed ridiculing it, which is a kind of sinister idea, but like an honest statement as well. And you talk about how Baby Cha-Cha is an early example of digital blackface. And I'm interested as to what your thoughts are on this relationship between this meme, originally a GIF idea of the white imagination, and its mass reproduction in mainstream media, like the importance of that moment, that image at that moment, at that time.
I mean, I think it's apt moment when we think about what it means to ridicule, to go back to the frame of the lynching postcard as we began and to think about what that did, right? Because when people note that this was a moment before the internet as we now know it, and of course, with the internet in its very foundings, right, inside of ARPANET and the late 1960s and early 1970s, the military industrial complex being part of that inception point, as we widen out from there and we think about, you know, what does it mean to have these materials like a lynching postcard relate back to the dancing baby as it came into a viral view, that the lynching postcard in many ways was a GIF still, right? It was a still image that would be transmitted and shared, and in its transmission became something that was both cinematic. It was both a cultural and social text, right? And as well, it became a collector's item. So this notion of what is to be kind of in that space, right, of kind of collecting that which is ridiculed, right, to think about the kind of disempowerment of an image and having it be something that can be owned and engaged with or without the consent of this idea of the material within it, right, is something that I think is a really important component of how we need to complicate these histories and how we need to as well be reflecting outward about where there is an interrelationship between these different points in history. So if we think about the lynching postcard as a kind of nascent form of a GIF, that, you know, when we think about this idea of spectacle and, you know, this idea of as well the format of what it meant to have a site of ridicule, right, that people were engaging in, to meet within, right, to engage in a spectacle, a performance, a model of entertainment, right, that was immensely violent and extractive. The dancing baby is this bizarre and uncanny space in terms of this cultural moment that Gerard amplified and created because of the fact that this was a racialized body that could be shared and played on loop in a way that had never happened before. And I think that there are moments within, you know, many different points of discussion where people have contested that the Dancing Baby was a racialized site, right? That actually this is a material, you know, being questioned as being racialized. But I think that the evidence towards that really is that as it has changed form and kind of mutated over time, one of the core things that it has embodied is many different racial stereotypes. So there are all different sorts of sort of ethnographic versions of the Dancing Baby that have perpetuated over time. And that in its inception, right, it is this kind of Afro-Cuban frame of this baby child that sets itself as the initial blueprint for these other forms to then begin to mutate and embody, right, really stereotypical forms of cultural and social frame. So it is, I think, a really bizarre moment in time that the very idea that we would begin with a child, right, and a Black child at that, that, you know, is intended to be ridiculed and dehumanized as a part of an exercise to see how images can move. And, you know, with that too, right, it speaks to, you know, aspects of how within this broader text of the Black meme, you know, we're really reflecting on how we are grappling with and wrestling with assumptions around humanity, right? Who and what is defined as human, and how, of course, technology advances that or disempowers it. And of course, with this being a key component in the history of not only the internet, right, but of visual culture and its virality overall, that these are key points to begin to think about in relationship to both the internet and also to a broader vernacular around broadcast, right? What does it mean to have an amplification that is not only local and national, but is international and as such, an inherent point of exchange and communion and entertainment. So, you know, shaping further this idea of Blackness as a mimetic material and as a point of extractive raw data, right? This is a literal manifestation of that data and how it takes on a physical and social form.
I found particularly interesting your focus on the creation and circulation of images of Breonna Taylor, a 27-year-old woman whose killing in 2020 at the hands of multiple police officers who had forced their way into her home, of course, sparked global outrage. But what was to come in terms of image form was quite remarkable. Magazine covers and objects like mugs were then sold on sites like Etsy, surfacing these ideas of a Black femme visibility existing as the decorative. And you question in Black Meme whether this type of hyper-visibility guarantees a system of erasure and reduction. And in Black Meme, you ask, is Breonna Taylor's afterlife one that lives on as a ornamentalized totem? Is it yet another system of erasure compounded by repetition? And you really contextualize within this section of the book so much of what I know that I personally felt at the time around this image circulation of Breonna Taylor, as so many others felt at the time, but perhaps could not articulate. There was so much else going on as well, and it was a lot. But can you tell us a little bit more about the forces at play that have guaranteed this reductive and perhaps harmful memorializations of Black people, or most often Black victims after death, and the way that these dignity campaigns of the decorative, as you call them in your book, are churned out at the expense of perhaps true justice and safety, a sense of safety and justice? Like, what is going on here? And I'm just really interested in your thoughts about those images at the time and how they were shared.
I mean, I mentioned consent before, and I think for me, thinking about that point to present, and then also just, of course, the many points along the way as we explore in Black Meme as a text, is that consent is a huge component of this. And the troubling part of what has occurred with Breonna Taylor and the afterlife of Breonna Taylor is this question of how her likeness has been used and manipulated, quite frankly, with or without different types of consent to be built into that process. And so you know, when we think about the frame of the GIF, right, and how GIFs have been exchanged as a medium and material, right, we're also thinking through, you know, what does a GIF teach us, right? It kind of allows us to feel empowered by manipulating images to serve our own means, right? That GIFs are visual representations of political and social discourse that are intersectional with ongoing things that are taking place in the world. And that, you know, Breonna Taylor's image, right, has kind of been subsumed within sheer acceleration of these technologies through and beyond the internet, and very much so has been contested as being a kind of decorative material, right? So we've seen Breonna Taylor's images on t-shirts and on mugs and on bumper stickers and inside of various Instagram slides, you know, and within this too, I think it, you know, becomes a really important question to ask, you know, to what end and to what form. I appreciate that a part of this is about, and this is very much so within the kind of engine and algorithm, the language of social media, that we boost these materials that are tied to these deep and violent fractures within our society as a means of really resisting and refusing our extinction, right? The very possibility of our extinction or the violence that's being enacted against our bodies. But at the same time, I think that aspects of this hypervisibility creates a dynamic where, you know, it almost becomes a hyper object, right? There is no edge to it, right? So actually we are unclear as to where parts of this begin and end and where, of course, there is agency bound up in this and what as well would be a stopping place for, you know, a rest and reflection inside of what is a mass acceleration of images, their reproduction and their circulation outside of the maybe source of grief, really, and memorialization that they were intended to initiate. So, you know, there is this kind of very complicated and quite frankly, tense relationship between this kind of space of honoring, right? And as well, the traditions of that within Black space, you know, the visibility of that within Black space, how Black people have always taken up aspects of memorialization and grieving by creating images, right, that can do that gorgeous work. But within that too, having it seized upon by non-Black people and as well having it circulated within a white imagination as being something that is patterned almost, right? So this is where the question around the decorative and what dignity there is within that becomes something that is more of a hazard than a possibility for healing. So within the discussion of Black meme, the question around, you know, what does it mean to have these images repeated over and over again? How do we think differently about having aspects of these moments in time that are incredibly violent, incredibly intimate, right? Cited on a global stage and then played back to us at points without a full awareness of their context. And as well, right, where the figure itself, in this case of Breonna Taylor, becomes elevated to a point of symbolism that actually we forget the context around the event itself of her death and her killing, right? So these are parts of the kind of core questions that my hope is that we can kind of slow down and reflect on and also think about in relationship to how we create space to share these images, because there is, I think, an opportunity here to slow down and to reflect on why it is that we feel entitled to share material specific to these various moments that continue to happen to Black people without asking questions about agency and authorship and the frame of that and maybe how it needs to be redefined in order for us to better understand and articulate the impact of this Black transmission through the technologies that we engage today.
Concluding with just one final question as we follow the trajectory of Black meme, I know that the listeners would be curious to know what your thoughts are on where we are now, where digital culture stands in relation to the future, perhaps more specifically what efforts can be made or continue to be made as part of a process of digital decolonization as we look to the future.
I have to say that, you know, when people ask me about what does it mean to decolonize the digital, I think it's immensely complicated because of the fact that it exists in so many intersections around us. But one of the core and primary challenges is really that technodiversity is failing. We are seeing more and more that there are these mammoth monopolies of industrial technical complexes within the work of producing content and material that is consolidating how we are viewing and transmitting these materials into single channels, right, that are running alongside of each other. So there are less and less spaces that are weird spaces or wild spaces or spaces produced and operated by Black people or, thinking as well about folks who are presenting a different viewpoint alongside of what are these tech giants, right? And so this, I think, is something that's really complicated because on the one hand, I believe deeply that, you know, as exists in the world, there are always going to be opportunities to kind of glitch and refuse and create strategies of opacity within these larger complexes of technology. But I also, at the same time, think it's really important for us to reflect on the very real risk and danger of having aspects of our technodiversity narrowed so completely that we are limited in our choice and as a result, stripped of our agency. So there's that. And then I will also say, you know, oftentimes there has been discussion around this idea of decolonial practices as resisting empire, right? And I think that the how we are framing empire, that, you know, when we look at the ways in which the material of the internet has continued to expand, right? It is the largest visual culture institution in the world. I love to push people to think about it that way, right? Maybe the most important museum that is not a museum, right? And that I think is a really important thing to reflect on, while at the same time, right, that the kind of questions of objecthood and provenance and conservation within this, right, in terms of what is reproduced and transmitted, again, has, I think, a very singular point of view and becomes incredibly complicated when we think about the frame of the algorithm and you know, how, of course, that too becomes a system of control and containment in creating limited space for us to be able to have other perspectives enter into the frame of this next chapter as we think about the future of what this work needs to be. So for me, like, I want the future of digital decolonization to create more avenues for us to have those types of discussions. And I think that the economies around that are significant. I actually don't know if it will be an opportunity where we will see, for example, a Black Instagram, right? I think that it is not as simple as that. I think that we are going to see more and more that folks who are quote unquote content creators, right? You know, people who are inside of the engines of these systems are going to have to think strategically and radically about the systems both of alienation within these spaces and also of capital and economy and how individually perhaps individuals can set a precedent and a benchmark for institutionalizing independently within these systems to create new spaces that can help us think differently about, you know, the sort of stage of capitalism that we are in and how, of course, it continues to accelerate. So those are some of the core points that come to mind. But, you know, I also just note that aspects of internet as it is, right, they're part of the impetus for Black Meme and thinking about why it is that this text needs to exist and why it is that it's, I feel, a very important story to be told, is this very assumption that, you know, the frame of the internet and its assumptions around transphobia, homophobia, ableism, you know, racism, classism, sexism, that all of these things, right, are somehow troubled because of the internet. When in reality, these were troubles, as we can see, that have mapped back to the 1900s and before, that have shaped and established the very frame within which we have been able to put language to our visual culture and that, you know, have infused the internet and built it for what it is today, right? So these things being separated out and kind of, you know, where we ask ourselves to place responsibility and accountability, right? I think we make a huge mistake when we reflect purely on this moment of time that we are in now and the versions of technology that exists now as if no other moment in time in history has driven that or connected that before. It is an immensely problematic read. And you know, as well, thinking about how aspects of these things are schooled, right? When they enter into the academy space and people are talking about art and technology or visual culture and technology, to just study aspects of a internet as we are now defining it is in itself something that is incredibly short-sighted. So the great hope is that when we think about digital decolonization, that we are looking backwards in addition to looking forwards, and we're thinking about what are the ways in which aspects of these systems can inform differently our thinking through some of the very urgent need to troubleshoot and advance a different type of view and strategy as we hope for and really invest in a future, both of art and of the world.
Well, thank you so much for facilitating that journey that we're on, both looking backwards as well as forwards. It was an absolute pleasure reading your book, and thank you so much for joining me today, Legacy. It was a pleasure talking with you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, it's Lou here. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Legacy as much as I did. I really enjoyed the way that she surfaced such relevant cultural and political activity to highlight the central role of Black contributions to the development of the meme as we know it today. Black Meme will be available for purchase online and in stores from May the 7th. And before I head off, I'd like to thank you for listening to Series 10 of Shade Podcast and to this episode, which is the series finale. Thank you for supporting this Black independent arts podcast and for pulling up for these conversations. See you next time. Subscribe to Shade Podcast to listen to all the episodes in this series. Also explore Shade Art Review on Substack, joining thousands of art-curious listeners like you who are discovering more about the work of visual artists from the Black diaspora. There you'll find art listings, comment, artist spotlights, and guest posts, and free subscriptions are available. But for the full Shade Art Review experience, sign up today to receive 20% off your annual membership, an offer which is available for the duration of this series. This series of Shade Podcasts was produced and hosted by me, Lou Mensah, and mixed by Tess Davidson. See you next time.